Speaking of Faith is supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. PewTrusts.com. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, ethics, and ideas. Today, Children of Abraham. In forsaking the worship of idols and proclaiming a faith in one God, Abram became Abraham, the spiritual ancestor of the three monotheistic religions. Judaism claims him. Christianity claims him.
Rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham, rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham, rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham, oh, rock my soul.
And Islam claims him. In what would have been somewhere between 2100 to 1500 BCE, it is written that Abraham was born in Ur of the Chaldeans, southeast of present-day Baghdad. He migrated to a desert outpost in Turkey, and there, when he was 75 years old, sacred texts say that God spoke to him and he responded.
The Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and curse him that curses you. And all of the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you."
Following God's call, Abraham traveled through modern-day Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and finally to what we now know as the West Bank. His legacy is at the heart of political and military conflict, yet he's buried in a shrine where even today Jews and Muslims pray side by side. The story which has made its way most vividly into Western imagination is the sacrifice or binding of Isaac, Abraham's son by his wife Sarah, born, the Bible says, when she was in her 90s and he was over 100. But Abraham had another earlier son, Ishmael, who was born to an Egyptian slave, Hagar. Even in the Hebrew Bible's account, God declares that Ishmael, like Isaac, will spawn a great nation. And today, the world's 1.2 billion Muslims consider Ishmael to be their spiritual ancestor, their line of direct descent from Abraham. Abraham and Sarah's son Isaac became the father of Jacob, the first Israelite. When Christianity grew from Jewish roots, one of the core messages of the early apostles was that Gentiles too could become children of Abraham. In fact, the very first line of the very first book of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, opens like this: "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Today on Speaking of Faith, we'll hear from Bruce Feiler, a traveler and journalist who wrote about cultures as far-flung as Japan and Nashville before he turned his attention and found himself transfixed by the stories of the Holy Land.
It wasn't really a spiritual quest, as odd as that might seem today. It was, you can't open a newspaper or turn on a television without hearing reference to these stories. And then in the summer of 97, I went to visit an old friend who lived in Jerusalem. I actually think it's sort of a mark of my lack of spirituality that I'd been to 60 countries at this point, sprained my ankle on four continents, and never been to the Middle East. And I went to visit my friend, and on the first day we went to this promenade overlooking the city, and my friend said, "Over there is Har Choma, the controversial neighborhood, and over there is the rock where Abraham sacrificed Isaac." And it was, these are real places you can touch and visit and feel. And this crazy way I live my life, I thought, well, here's an idea. What if I enter the Bible as if it were one of these worlds and seek to become a part of it?
He wrote Walking the Bible, a New York Times bestseller. And then in ways Bruce Feiler could not have foreseen, his discovery of the power of religious stories came to mirror a journey he believes American culture as a whole has been on, especially since 9/11. His 2002 book, Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths, became an unexpected national sensation. I asked Bruce Feiler why a largely secular Jew from Savannah, Georgia, should care about Abraham. At his bar mitzvah when he was 13, he says, he read aloud the Torah portion where God calls Abraham to go forth. And on the same day, his father told him, "You're a man now." He now hears his father's words as a version of what God said to Abraham. But did he, I ask, make such a profound connection at that young age?
I always knew that this was the passage that I had read. I was fortunate that it's this epic moment in the history of the world when God chooses Abraham and Abraham chooses God. I also understood in my own identity that one of the reasons that I could travel to all these places and live abroad for most of my 20s and write these books about, you know, all these different places around the world was that I came from a place, right? So that I felt attached to something. It's been my observation that people who wander feel attached, and the people who want to settle down sort of felt dislocated when they were young in many cases. So I feel like that I understood, but I didn't really put the whole thing together. And in some ways, I feel that these questions, why I did Walking the Bible, why I went searching for Abraham, and now this book is having this reaction on the cover of Time magazine. And, you know, at this moment when it's catching in the way that it is, I find myself going back to that initial moment of why really did I do this? And I feel like I can keep revisiting that forever and never really understand.
It's the way Scripture works, too, isn't it?
Yes.
When it's living.
I said this so many times in all the conversations I ever had about Walking the Bible, that the objective of that experience, and in some ways the destination of that experience, was the Bible's not an abstraction, that book gathering dust. It is a living, breathing entity, intimately connected to those places and to all of us. And in some ways, to my surprise, but maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, that's the story of Abraham, is that there is this figure in the past. Or is there a figure in the past? And then every generation for 2,000 years has chosen an Abraham for itself.
What do you mean when you say that?
Well, what I mean is first a little bit of narrative here. I mean, basically, Walking the Bible comes out, becomes this book that touches hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm actually off working on a follow-up, the rest of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, when I get a call from my brother saying, "Look outside your window." It's September 11th, 2001. I'm in New York. I watch the towers fall. And in those weeks afterward, we began to hear, who are they? Why do they hate us? Can the religions get along? And I do think that one name echoes behind those conversations. One man is at the heart of the religions that suddenly seem to be at war. Abraham, Abraham, Abraham. So 2 weeks after that date, I get up and I go on this journey. And essentially, I believe now, in retrospect, that I was, and I believed at the time, I was looking for one Abraham. I was looking for this figure who sort of was out in the desert somewhere, some sort of great oasis that I could unveil to the world and we could all hold hands and dance kumbaya around the campfire. What happened, the big surprise of this journey, was I wasn't looking for one Abraham. Turns out I was looking for 250 different Abrahams.
Well, that's what you found. You found that there were 250 different Abrahams.
Yes, because basically, The basic fact, as you know, is that there's no archaeological evidence that any of the great epic events in Genesis ever took place. You would think that that would be problematic for the religions who base their identity in part on his life story. Instead, the opposite happened, which is that each of the religions essentially just chucked out the initial story and proceeded to make up its own Abraham. And therein lies this great tension, because the story in Genesis is this universal story. God blesses Abraham. He blesses both of his children. Ishmael, even after Ishmael is kicked out into the desert, and Isaac, both are blessed by God. But what happened is the religions tried to elbow aside one another. So basically Jews, when they felt insecure, tried to turn Abraham into a Jew. So in the Jewish commentaries, you start to see that Abraham is the reason God created the world, which occurred 1,000 years before Abraham was born. Abraham becomes the reason for Passover, even though Moses lived 1,000 years after Abraham was dead. Abraham even keeps kosher, which wasn't invented until 1,500 years after Abraham died. And so basically they made Abraham into a Jew. And here's the thing, like, this is the great gift of Judaism that allowed these biblical figures to continue to be alive, which is, they said, they didn't just live then, they also live now.
Right.
But that gift also has a curse, which is it opens this door and everybody else comes rushing through.
So there's something here about a religious sense of time. I mean, which Judaism perhaps preserves better than anyone, that that the Exodus story didn't just happen to your ancestors, it happened to your ancestors and it happened to you, right?
Yes, and that and in fact, it's with the Exodus the first time that the Bible actually addresses the reader directly and says, you will relive this every year. Mm-hmm. You will relive it. I mean, not just read it, but actually enter it yourself.
And so what you're saying is that that also happens with Abraham. Is it your experience that happens with Abraham in other traditions as well?
Absolutely happens in other traditions. Early Christians like Paul also were interested in Abraham as a universal figure. His blessing could be open not just to Jews, Paul says, but also to Gentiles. And that's a universal thing. But what happens is, over time, as Christianity grows more powerful and Judaism begins to diminish after the destruction of the Second Temple, the early Christians begin to use Abraham not as a figure to include Gentiles, but to exclude Jews. So they say God didn't call Abraham to go forth. Jesus called Abraham to go forth. God didn't promise the land to descendants of Abraham, but to followers of Jesus. So, in other words, in the way that Jews turned Abraham into a Jew when he wasn't a Jew, Christians turned him into a Christian when he wasn't a Christian either. And you can see where this story is going. Islam does the exact same thing. In the early years of Islam, Muhammad says Abraham is a figure open not just to Abraham, to Jews and Christians, but to Muslims. But over time, when Islam grows more powerful, they begin to say, you know what? Abraham preferred Ishmael to Isaac. He actually sacrifices Ishmael in many Muslim beliefs today, and not Isaac. And he doesn't do it in Jerusalem, as Jews and Christians believe, but in Mecca. And they even basically say he calls for the pilgrimage and builds the Kaaba, the big black house in the middle of Mecca. So they turn him into a Muslim. And basically, most of my waking hours were spent trying to untangle this knot, how the universal figure of Genesis, who spreads his blessing to everyone, becomes this object of bloody rivalry among his descendants.
A family feud, you say.
The big, greatest family feud in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. And one that seems to be the defining feud of our time since September 11th.
I think it is the defining feud of our time.
Journalist and author Bruce Feiler, today on Speaking of Faith, Children of Abraham. The multi-layered story of Abraham has inspired works of art and music across the ages, including in modern America. Bob Dylan mused over God's command that Abraham kill his son Isaac in Highway 61 Revisited.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, hold on Highway 61.
Louis Armstrong took solace in the story of the Egyptian servant woman who bore Abraham his first son, Ishmael, the ancestor of all Muslims, in this song, Aunt Hagar's Blues.
Up jumped Aunt Hagar and shouted out with all of might, those ever-loving blues. Just hear Aunt Hagar's children harmonizing to that old mournful tune.
This music is by Benjamin Britten. Written in the 1950s, it portrays the most dramatic moment in the life of Abraham as recounted in Genesis 22, the binding and near sacrifice of his beloved son Isaac in obedience to God. Through most of this two-person opera, one singer takes the role of Abraham, the other of Isaac. They act out the ancient story, the father taking his son to Mount Moriah, building an altar, where Abraham binds Isaac and, after heartbreaking farewells, raises his knife to slay him.
Oh,
this climactic moment, the two voices which had been separate sing together the sudden proclamation of God. Abraham, lay not thy sword in no manner on Isaac, thy dear darling. From Benjamin Britten's Canticle No. 2. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith. I'm talking this hour with Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible and Abraham.
I wonder for myself how Americans of every faith might approach and interpret and even be involved in the conflict in the Middle East differently if they didn't accept the categories of discourse of the political realm. In other words, that it's not just a place on the map, that for Muslims and Christians and Jews, it is the Holy Land. And if the discourse and the action of people of faith was more shaped by their common sense of that.
You would think that this story is so barbaric that it would have died out over time. Instead, Jews read the story in their holiest week of the year at Rosh Hashanah. Christians read it in their holiest week of the year at Easter. Muslims read it, the same story, in their holiest week at the end of the pilgrimage, because it asks the question we hope never to face: would I kill for God? And as we learned on September 11th, for many, the answer is still yes.
So we're talking, let's just clarify, we're talking about Genesis 22, right?
Yes.
The sacrifice of Isaac, which is an absolutely fascinating piece of scripture. And, you know, one thing I know about Genesis 22 is how very unique it is and how little referenced it is, right? I mean, there are so many more pivotal events in the Hebrew Bible. The Israelites are never told to relive the sacrifice of Isaac the way they are the Exodus. In fact, it's extraordinary how
It's never mentioned in the rest of the Hebrew Bible. It is not referenced explicitly in the New Testament either.
Right.
It never comes up. It only comes up when, in the political context, it first reemerges as an important story in the Maccabean time and in the Hasmonean era, right before the birth of Christ, because Jews are being oppressed. And oppressed Jews look back to the story of the binding, but they don't look at Abraham. They look at Isaac.
Right.
And they say, in the way that Isaac suffers, then that is a model for how to suffer. Now, then what happens is along comes the early Christians. They begin to see in Genesis 22 a mirror, if you will, or a precursor, depending on how you want to describe it, of what happens with the sacrifice of Jesus. And they begin to say, well, Abraham stopped short of sacrificing Isaac. God did not stop short of sacrificing Jesus. And some suggest this means God loved Jesus more than Abraham loved Isaac. And what Jews do, and this is what's so fascinating, is then they say, well, we're not going to let you have this story. We're going to reinterpret it. And so then there's this really powerful midrash that is developed after Christ, which becomes really popular in the Middle Ages, that says Isaac actually did die, that Abraham killed Isaac, that he went away for 3 days, and then came back.
And he went to heaven, or he was ministered to by God and the angels.
And they find the hook in the text is that the angel tells Abraham not to slay the son twice. And so they say the first time he did it, he then comes back, and then the second time they repeat it. This becomes so popular that Jews in the Middle Ages actually put ashes on their forehead to commemorate the slaying of Isaac. And if that sounds familiar, it's because it is familiar, because they were taking it from Christianity. And what you begin, this is what you see with Abraham and why the story is so naughty, because these interpretations went back and forth and are as much a reflection of the rivalry among the religions as they are a reflection of the original gaps or ideas in the story.
This is Speaking of Faith. Bruce Feiler is a journalist and traveler and the author of Walking the Bible and Abraham. After a short break, more of my conversation with him. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us.
Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website, at speakingoffaith.org. Speaking of Faith is a production of Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, ethics, and ideas. Today, Children of Abraham. Across the ages, the story of Abraham has been told and retold by the three religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. My guest today, Bruce Feiler, points out that there are tantalizing gaps in the story, which lend themselves to different interpretations. Jews draw their lineage from Abraham's family tree through Isaac, while Muslims draw theirs through Ishmael, Abraham's son born of a servant woman. When in the Hebrew Bible, God commands Abraham to sacrifice Isaac by saying, "Take your son, your only son whom you love," even ancient rabbis speculated about Abraham's confusion since he had two sons he loved. And here is a devotional Muslim text that supposes it was Ishmael about to be sacrificed and imagines what was going through his mind.
O my father, if you desire my sacrifice, nothing is imposed on you from me. Tie me in a firm bond, because I don't think that I'll be able to endure it when I feel death's touch. When you lay me down to sacrifice me, lay me down on my face. Don't put me down on my side, because I'm afraid that if you look at my face, you will turn soft and abandon the command of God.
And here is a reading from the Hebrew Bible's tumultuous account of Ishmael's early life and the fate of his mother, Hagar.
Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham playing. She said to Abraham, "Cast out that slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave shall not share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." The matter distressed Abraham greatly, for it concerned a son of his. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed over the boy or your slave. Whatever Sarah tells you, do as she says, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be continued for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him too, for he is your seed." Early next morning, Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder together with the child and sent her away. And she wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water was gone from the skin, she left the child under one of the bushes and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away, for she thought, "Let me not look on as the child dies." And sitting thus afar, she burst into tears. Genesis 21, 9 through 16.
So you have the Bible's first homeless single mother, Hagar, who's been cast
out. Proof positive that everybody can, every generation can have their interpretation
That's
of the
right.
story.
Well, seriously, though, there she is. And as you pointed out in your book, the Hebrew Bible strangely makes room for incredible sympathy towards Hagar and her son.
I do think that that is the headline. The Bible does not treat losers or apostates or whatever you want to call them well. Abel is murdered. Lot's wife turns into a pillar of salt. What happens here with Ishmael is that he's kicked out into the desert. Remember, Abraham comes down, Sarah gives him Hagar, Ishmael is born, da-dam, but as soon as Ishmael is born, Sarah gets pregnant and Isaac is born.
So Sarah wants them away.
And Sarah says to Abraham, kick Ishmael out into the desert. And he clearly doesn't want to. Ishmael is his first son. He's been looking for a son for 90 years at that point. And what happens is God says it's okay, that he too will become a great nation. And so Ishmael is kicked out into the desert, but unlike a lot of people, figures in the Bible, he never leaves Abraham's realm of love and paternity, and he never leaves the sphere of God's blessing. And what is interesting is how the text seems to be bending over backwards to create a sort of balance.
Yes.
Ishmael goes out into the desert, but his mother, Hagar, is much more elevated. Isaac gets the land, but through the malice of his mother. Hagar is the only person, male or female, in the Hebrew Bible to ever speak and name God directly. And God promises Abraham that he will have many generations, Isaac and Jacob, but he promises the same to Hagar, which means Hagar is, in effect, a female patriarch. And this balance, I think, is stunning because the split, when this story comes along, the split among the religions is still thousands of years in the future. And yet the text seems to understand that all of these people are related to one another, mm-hmm. that there will be violence, but there also is peace. I mean, the thing that I hold on to here, one of the last things I did, as you know, is I went to Hebron, one of the bloodiest cities on the planet, the epicenter of Muslim-Jewish conflict. Mm-hmm. I drove south on this sniper road where the Israelis and Palestinians shoot at one another before arriving at the Tomb of the Patriarchs. It's this giant building that looks like a cross between a gymnasium and a castle. The last time I had been there, there were 10,000 Jews dancing at a festival. Today it was empty. So dangerous that four soldiers with helmets and machine guns had to escort me inside. Four. And I go to this little tiny room between Abraham and Sarah's tomb. All three faiths agree this is where they're buried. There's a ramshackle synagogue there with a chandelier hanging down with half the bulbs out. And it's there that Abraham at 175 dies. And in one of the most haunting and overlooked passages in the Hebrew Bible, in Genesis 25:9, his sons Ishmael and Isaac, rivals since before they were born, estranged since childhood, leaders of opposing nations, come, stand side by side, and bury their father. Abraham achieves in death what he could never achieve in life, this moment of reconciliation, a hopeful side-by-side flicker of possibility when they're not rivals or warriors, Jews, Christians, or Muslims. They are brothers.
Is that incident also referenced in the Quran?
The thing about the Quran that's important to remember here, as you know, is that it never really tells the story.
Right, it's not a chronological
mm-hmm. narrative. It sort of refers mm-hmm. back, and it says sort of remember when. So it's not mentioned explicitly, but most of the events in Abraham's life are not mentioned. What I think is relevant here is that this is also a Muslim shrine. It's been a Muslim shrine for hundreds of years. Muslims and Jews now divide the shrine. In some ways, the shrine is sort of an awkward but really practical model for how you can get along. It ain't pretty. Like, Jews and Muslims, they split the shrine, and 10 days a year, each side gets unlimited access to it. It's almost like, wow, ain't pretty, but it does work. I'm like, maybe that's the model here. But what's important to me about that moment is that they stand side by side. It doesn't say they hugged. Doesn't say they had dinner. Doesn't say they moved in and sat down and said, you know, let's forgive. And remember, Abraham tried to kill each of them. Like, to me, that is the model. And again, the text seems to understand, predict almost, where we're going to be so many thousands of years later. So it's not, the destination here is not some Esperanto mumbo jumbo of a giant religion. It's standing side by side and respecting that coexistence.
This is Speaking of Faith, and I'm Krista Tippett. I'm in conversation with Bruce Feiler, the author of Abraham. In this book, he describes his discovery of the Middle East as the cradle of God. How, I asked, has this changed the way he understands what happens in that part of the world?
In the weeks after September 11th, the feeling that began to rise up inside of me was one of being violated, a sort of physical sense of being afraid. And it was confusing to me. And then one day I recognized that feeling. It's the feeling one has every day in the Middle East, of terror and pride and connection to place. For me, September 11th, 2001 is the day the Middle East came to America. And I think the reason that that's important is that until that time, I still think there was a separation between those places and our place. I think that separation has had long since gone away for Europe. If you go back to the Crusades, if you go back even to English history, where so much of it is connected to the Middle East because it's so much closer. And I think that what's happened now is the idea that we are different from that land, that this land is separate from that land, is gone away. If you listen to the conversation in America today, any day, any place, on the radio, on television, at a dinner table, it has to do with those themes about the intersection of God and politics and geography. Like, that is that little triangle, God, the politics, and land. That is the Abrahamic triangle, because Abraham, God promises Abraham land. That little triangle is the defining story of the Hebrew Bible. And if we do not understand that land is part of it, you take land out of it, you don't understand it. And now I think that triangle is something that is, it has really resonated deeply with Americans. And therefore, the answer to your question, in my view, is that we have to realize that is not happening there. Mm-hmm. It's happening here also.
And if we'd been taking our texts and religious traditions more seriously, even this biblical view of time that you and I talked about a minute ago, I mean, that distance was always collapsed. And, you know, you think there are groups, say, of evangelical Christians in this country who've insisted on that connection. It seems to me what's new is that it's come to the rest of Americans as well.
And it's no longer metaphoric. That largely the way it's conducted in America, yes, there's always been this fascinating connection between evangelical Christians mm-hmm. and Zionist
Israel.
Jews
mm-hmm.
because of the land issue. But for most people, while most people understand that, I can take a lesson from the scripture and relate it to my life. I do think a lot of people who are believers, who engage it, I think that they get that connection. But the difference is now it affects place. Right. And that's the thing that Americans feel most passionate about, right? Our land. I mean, look at the just upsurging, uncontrollable upsurging of patriotism that occurred after September 11th. At times it's been over the top, because now it's place. Like, now it's we're threatened. And that's the equation that I think that we miss here when we only read it as metaphor and as story, as opposed to something that's real and that has sort of geographic consequences.
Okay, so it's not just that the sense of that part of the world, that the sense of land and place has impinged on us, but that we are developing that sense within ourselves of our own place.
We are realizing that we carry those places around within us, and that what happens to those places affects us and affects our faith.
Bruce Feiler, author of Abraham. Here is a traditional prayer recited in the Muslim world from Morocco to India.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ala alihi kama sallaita ala Ibrahim wa barik ala Muhammadin wa ala ali Muhammad kama barakta ala ali Ibrahim fil alameen innaka hamidun majid. O our Lord, bless Muhammad and his family as you blessed Abraham. Send your spiritual power upon Muhammad and upon the family of Muhammad as you sent your spiritual power upon the family of Abraham in this universe and in all universes. Indeed, you are praiseworthy and noble.
In much of the devotional tradition of Islam, the prophet Abraham is linked to the prophet Muhammad. The two of them, along with Noah, Moses, and Jesus, are held up as the greatest examples of guidance that the divine has sent to humanity. The literal meaning in the Arabic of the word Islam is submission to the will of God. And Abraham, who turned away from the idol worship of his ancestors, is considered to have been the first Muslim. The Quran includes reference to many of the events of Abraham's life, which are also in the Hebrew Bible. Ishmael, Abraham's son by an Egyptian woman, Hagar, is considered to be the ancestor of all Muslims. And according to the Quran's account of Abraham's life, he once made a trip to visit Ishmael in what is now Saudi Arabia. And there, he laid the foundation of the Holy Mosque of Mecca. In the Muslim ritual of Hajj, the pilgrimage which every Muslim hopes to make once in his or her life,
virtually every ritual is tied to Abraham. Here is the prayer Abraham is said to have offered on that site, read by Omid Safi.
وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ اجْعَلْ هَذَا بَلَدًا آمِنًا وَارْزُقْ أَهْلَهُ. O my Lord, make this a city of peace and feed its people, give sustenance to its people.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith. I'm in conversation this hour with Bruce Feiler. His book about Abraham, an ancient story which begins in modern-day Iraq and ends on what is now the West Bank city of Hebron, has touched a national nerve that surprised even him. From the cover of Time magazine to Abraham study groups in major cities across America, Abraham seems to have a power to bring people of different faiths together.
I mean, look, we are at this moment. We can continue to go where we're going, which is all-out warfare among the religions. Or we can find an alternative way. And I think that the September 11th is going to be seen as a defining moment in the interfaith movement because, among other things, it's flushed out the people who actually believe in a lot of its values but who didn't realize that they needed to speak up. Mm-hmm. And that they needed to reach out. And
Who are you thinking of when you say that?
What I'm thinking of is every city in America has an interfaith movement that's popped up in the last 4 or 5 years, and that has really surged forward in the last year. In Portland, Oregon, they got 800 people participating in an Abraham initiative. In Portland, Maine, they had 3 representatives of the 3 faiths, children of Abraham, under this umbrella of Abraham, to go be the governor to sign a peace agreement, okay? In Minneapolis, Minnesota, in Atlanta, Georgia, in Muncie, Indiana, every one of these places, in Charlottesville, Virginia, they all have these interfaith things that are coming up, and they're all using the rubric of Abraham to have this conversation. So it's like, oh, I guess we do have to speak out, if not the fanatics and the extremists will carry the day.
Someone I had a wonderful conversation with earlier this year about fundamentalism is Yossi Klein Halevi, who I see mentioned in your book also. And so one thing that he said that changed the way I have watched all this unfold is that whereas even in the peace processes that Americans lead often, and when Americans try to make sense of the news from the Middle East, we tend to try to bracket out the explicitly religious dimension, the theological dimension of what's going on. I mean, whether Abraham matters is not really a question that would seem relevant. But what Yossi Klein Halevi said is that, you know, you bracket that out, you're not going to understand or be able to get close to what's going on there or to any possible future solution. So I think it feels frightening to include this explosive, irrational, subjective, religious dimension of that part of the world. But, you know, what have you learned about how that's possible and what changes when you bring figures like Abraham into the way you think about the news over there?
I went to see a woman named Petra Helt, who is a German reverend who had studied the use of Abraham in early Christian texts. And actually, Yossi Klein Halevi is the one who introduced me to her. And I went to see her. And she was interesting. When I was sitting with her, she had her hands between her legs as if she was trying to hide something. And it turned out, I learned later, she had been in one of the suicide bombings and had been injured, and her hands were covered in these grafts, and she was still self-conscious. And we were talking about this the fact that each of the religions, the interpretations over time, have tended to make Abraham into this sort of radical exclusive figure for each of the religions and not the universal figure. I jumped out. I was in this library, and there was a whole bunch of chairs. And I'm like, well, you're there, and you're Abraham, and I'm here, and there's 2 centuries worth of bookshelves between you and me. What am I going to do? And she said, well, just push them over. I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, well, just push them over. Her point to me was you're never going to be able to eliminate this dimension that you're talking about, that each of the traditions has a series of customs and a series of legends and a series of beliefs that have been built up and ossified over time. Realizing that you can have an interpretive tradition for Abraham, he can have a interpretive tradition for Abraham, and I can have an interpretive tradition for Abraham. But the thing is, as Walter Brueggemann, the great theologian, said to me, you just cannot believe that your interpretive tradition is the only one. You're allowed to believe what you believe, and I'm allowed to believe what I want to believe, but I can't believe that the mind is the only way. So I don't think the route is to go around the religions. I think that the interfaith movement has done that for a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the American instinct. It's just try to avoid what we've
sort of simplifies it and puts it on a more superficial level,
yes.
Right?
Whereas the harder thing, and what the smartest people I've talked to about this suggest to me, is that you have to accept that yours is an interpretive tradition, still believe it, but just don't believe that yours is hegemonic and therefore must be right. And I'm not saying that's easy, because I know that that's difficult.
Well, the way that makes sense to me is to say, this is what I believe to be true, and this is the tradition that is mine. But in each of our traditions, there's also an acknowledgement of the essential mystery and the fact that what we're trying to put words around is much bigger than we'll ever be able to grasp in this lifetime.
I believe that the stories contain an enormous amount of truth that is still relevant to my life and to most people's lives that I know. That really matters to me. And what I find myself doing is trying to go around the religions or go behind the religions back to the initial story. And I think I'm at the point where I got them all separate. I don't think they've all come back together.
Okay, so the stories are separate from the religion?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I think, you know, the religion is the carrier of those stories, or has functioned that way. I mean, that's one of the important
functions. Has proffered itself as.
Well, all right. Well, but has kept them alive in some sense, even through just, you know, writing down scriptures and passing them on to other generations for you to discover and read for yourself and decide that the way they taught them was not what you're reading.
Or maybe the stories are so great that they survived the religion sort of pounding them over time. I mean, you know, you could take your story. But yes, I mean, I'm not hostile toward the religions. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a way to integrate the religions back into this conversation. I'm just saying I haven't gotten all the way to doing that yet.
Okay.
I still have some lingering bitterness toward the religions for turning me off, I think, and turning a lot of other people off to the stories, because their religions are interested by nature in preserving themselves.
You're listening to a conversation with Bruce Feiler, the author of Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths. As he says, Abraham has a power to capture the imagination of modern people. In his multimedia piece, The Cave, minimalist contemporary composer Steve Reich synchronizes music with Muslim, Christian, and Jewish voices reciting texts and reflections on the Abraham story.
It was called on his name.
It was called.
It was called on his name.
Al-Khalil, which means friend of God.
They say that Abraham is a Jew. He was a Muslim.
I recently sat with someone I think is very wise, a rabbi named Brad Hirschfield in New York City, and we were having this conversation about my experience and why people have come to these books of mine. And Brad said something that has stuck with me, and that is that if you look at the last sort of, oh gosh, half century of American religious life, that you basically had people turn away from organized religion, we'll just say 30, 40 years ago for the purposes of this conversation. And they experimented with a lot of New Age things, da-da-da. And those don't seem to have as much currency. And certainly after September 11th, they have even less currency. So people were in religious institutions, broke away. And now what they seem to be doing is going back to traditional texts.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Kabbalah movement of 3 or 4 years ago is an example of that. And now people going back to the ancient texts looking for meaning. And then once they go back to those ancient texts, what they then tend to do is reinstitutionalize themselves.
Right.
Because people, once they go back to the text, feel the need for community.
But, I mean, I think that creates a more empowered religious sensibility, because if people, it's starting in a different place. It's not starting from what you've been spoon-fed or,
yes,
you know, the interpretations that have been handed down to you. But it's,
yes,
starting with reading the text for yourself, discovering that they have meaning, and then going with that knowledge back into what the institution has to offer.
I think that's exactly right. And
that's
the way in which I feel myself already and anticipate myself getting over this antipathy toward organized religion. It's sort of like what we all do with our parents, right? I mean, when we're young, what our parents tell us, we do, okay? Then we go through this rebellion with whatever our parents tell us, what we don't do. And ultimately we realize, you know what? Our parents are people. They care for us. We can listen. It's worth it to us to get their advice, but we don't have to accept their advice. And I think that's the same. There's a lot of truth in the way we relate to these religious institutions as well, mm-hmm. which is understanding that they are institutions. They have their own objectives. They have their own foibles. They have their own problems. They care for us, and I think they care for our souls, and they care for our moral well-being much more than most institutions in our life do. But we're not obliged to do everything that they tell us or just to accept the interpretations they give us.
So this has been a roundabout way of answering a question that I had, which is, you know, why I think the figure of Abraham is incredibly important, practically important, but it was a question in my mind why lots of Americans should see that, or, you know, why this should be on the cover of Time magazine, or if it can really have an effect. But now I'm sort of seeing that this figure can have a different relevance because of the sort of new religious sensibility of the time we're living in.
Well, first of all, I think there are some basic things that we ought not to forget because we're having this conversation at a high level, which is it is a family feud. And for a lot of people, that's a headline, that Jews and Christians and Muslims all came from the same land, from the same family, that Abraham is a figure that is central to Jews, Christians, and actually more central to Muslims than arguably to the other two. Mm-hmm. That's a really important realization that we do all come, and that also leads to the next assumption, which is that we all share the same God. And the reason that all three religions have gone back to Abraham, this is the thing, God chooses Abraham in Genesis 12, and Abraham chooses God. And then each of the religions over time has chosen to link itself back to Abraham because he's so closely associated with God. In a sense, you can't get to God without understanding Abraham. They could have chosen anybody. They could have chosen David. They could have chosen Moses. They could have chosen Isaac. They could have chosen Adam. They chose Abraham. That choice is powerful. And to me, that suggests that we can choose Abraham as well. We can choose an Abraham for this moment. Abraham number 241 is sort of what I say he is in my book. But that's just sort of a whimsical way of saying we can make him relevant to our time. And the moment that we live in now is the religion's about to descend into war. They've been at war for a long time, but the weapons are a lot bigger now. Planes are weapons. Nuclear bombs are weapons. And we need to remember at least that we do have this family feud, that at the center of it is one man. And I think he contains the seeds of hope. Because I really feel that the story of Abraham is not Pollyannish, and that's what's so great about it. Mm-hmm. There's violence in it as well as peace in it. He's a flawed vessel, but he is the best vessel we've got. And so I think that's why people are grabbing for him.
He's fully human.
He's fully human. He's fully us.
Bruce Feiler is the author of Walking the Bible and Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths. And here is a reading from Genesis 25, where the Hebrew Bible leaves the Abraham story.
This was the total span of Abraham's life, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last, dying at a good ripe age, old and contented, and he was gathered to his kin. His sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field that Abraham had bought from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah his wife.
We would love to hear your comments on this show and your reflections on the meaning of Abraham today. Please write to us at mail@mpr.org. That's M as in Minnesota, mpr.org. You can also write to us through our website, speakingoffaith.org. While you're there, you'll find resource and music lists, and you'll be able to listen to this program again as well as our previous programs. You can also call Minnesota Public Radio at 1-800-228-7123. Speaking of Faith is produced by Marge Ostroushko and Brian Newhouse. Mitch Hanley is our technical director. Our editor is Kate Moose, and our associate producer is Judy Nunnally. Special thanks for this program go to Alan Frechtman and Omid Safi. Omid Safi's new book, Progressive Muslims on Justice, Gender, and Pluralism, is published by One World. The executive producer of Speaking of Faith is Bill Buesenberg. I'm Krista Tippett.
Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website at speakingoffaith.org. Speaking of Faith is supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results, pewtrusts.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Speaking of Faith is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.